Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and it's a real treat and an honor to have Revis Wortham here with us today. He's going to be talking about his new book, Laying Bones, which is an absolute killer. It's funny, Revis, someone from your publisher sent me just a great book list review that just hit, and you're getting terrific reviews for this book. So welcome. It's great to have you here. Again, and then my good friend and your good friend, Joe Lansdale. What can we say about Joe? Master storyteller, Edgar Award winner, raconteur, Texas gentleman. And this is his most recent book, More Better Deals. And if you're truly bored, we did a great program, didn't we, Joe, back in July, I think, when it came out, or maybe no, earlier than that.
Right.
Yeah, but it's funny, before we got started here, these guys were talking about the weather in Texas and what's going on, and I got treated to a little bit of Texas talk, and so this is great. I'm really delighted, Joe, that you were able to come and talk to Revis, and I'll largely be, thankfully, in the background, everybody, but I'm going to be watching the Facebook feed, so if you have questions for Revis or Joe, please send them in, and I'll pop up at some point to ask some of those guys. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Joe.
Well, what I'm just going to talk about is I've been reading Revis for a while. It's been longer than I thought because, you know, time flies by when you're having a big time. And I think the first I ever spoke with Revis was on the phone. Am I right about that, or am I wrong about
that? That's right. That was back in the days when you could look phone numbers up in something called a phone book. And I found your number and I called you.
Yes, you did. Uh-huh. I remember that. And that was the first time I talked to him. And you can't always tell unless you read people's stuff. But I have learned over the years that I have a pretty good nose or ear when I talk to somebody to know if they have, you know, some dope going, so to speak. I mean, you can't always know if they can really apply it, but There, you have to have something that goes first before the writing, and that's that you have to be a reader, and that you also have to have a certain voice and a certain attitude and a certain willingness. And I think Revis, at that point in time, he might have been on his last string there, you know, thinking, God, man, what's happening here? And I thought, you know what? You just got to stick with it. I don't remember the details of our conversation. But I was telling him, you know, you got to stick with it, man, because I could tell this guy had something going. And I was right. I was right. He did. And he didn't quit. He wasn't going to quit anyway. He just called me to reinforce what he was already thinking, you know. And I realized that. And that's one reason I wanted to reinforce it, because I just thought, I'm going to see what this guy does. And then later, if it sucks, I'll say, I shouldn't have helped you. And then if it's good, like it turned out to be, I'll say, yeah, that was my fault.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, that's exactly right. I'd been writing newspaper columns and magazine articles for since 1988, and to date, I have over 2,000 of those articles and from magazines and newspapers. And I still write them once a week. They come out. That's where I learned. That's where I got my voice. But I wasn't getting anywhere in writing novels. I couldn't make it. No one. I would send these out. People would just the agents would send them back saying no, we don't like what this is. One agent in New York City said, it has trees in it. I don't represent trees. And so, you know, I was at my last leg. I didn't know about writers' conferences at that time. Now today, I mean, I know they're all over the country, but I didn't know what a writers' conference. I was green as grass. And so I needed somebody to talk to in the business. And I'd been reading Joe since a friend of mine handed me Happy Leonard, I think it was Mucho Mojo or Bad Chili, one of those two, long time ago. He said, you got to read this guy. He's from Texas, and he's the real deal, and you need to talk to him. But he didn't realize after I finished the book, that I was going to call him. So I called Joe up, and we spent some time on the phone. And Joe, you really did. You kept me going, because I think for a while there, I was just thinking about giving up on it and not doing it. But he encouraged a stranger that cold called him at home. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you can do that anymore or not. But that's what
people do it.
they still, yeah. Well, good. Because they know what kind of person you are. And in addition to being a great writer, Joe is just a great friend, and he's a friend to all if they treat him the right way. And so, you know, that's the way it ought to be. That's what we grew up doing, Joe. You know that you treat somebody like you expect to be treated. We're both from similar parts of the world. I'm from far northeast Texas, up in Lamar County on the Red River, and Joe's down around Nacogdoches, down behind the good part. The part with pine trees. Yeah, he's back there.
Pine trees, yeah.
Yeah, pulpwood country and not too far from the Rose Capital of Texas. So,
that's I used to work in the Rose Fields for the Rose Capital of Texas.
My God, you know, I can't even think about that. I pulled a cotton sack when I was little. My grandparents farmed and I picked cotton, pulled cotton sack a little bit. And I did that for not very long because I found out real quick. Number one, I had asthma and it locked me up. My doctor's bills were way more than what my parents got out of me picking cotton. But the second is it was hot work. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do this all my life. No,
get your fingers up. You got these bowls and people don't realize it's not just plucking a little piece of cotton out of that.
Oh, no.
Them damn things are sharp. At the end of the day, you know, you look like you've been in a fight with like one of those food choppers.
Exactly.
You know, you're all got your fingers all bloody and get little cuts all over them and stuff. And I did it once when I was really, really young, just kind of my parents let me do it because I wanted to do it and I never wanted to do it again. But I ended up picking peas and beans and we did what we call picking pecans. They'd have a machine that shook a tree and all the pecans would fall out of it. And then we'd all pick them up and get paid by the pound.
Yeah,
and I remember I said, I don't know why they don't just put a tarp around this, pass some ropes, and just pull the tracker. But shut up.
Lose money.
Yeah, we were working for H.L. Hunt, you know, the big guy, and I thought, well, he can't figure that out. Maybe it's best because we got paid by the pound. My mother and I used to do that when nothing else was available and there wasn't any other work. And I guess I was a teenager in early. Middle teens, late teens. And so I used to do that some. So I know all those, I done all them hot, miserable jobs, you know, and East Texas is not only hot, it's uncomfortable because it's got humidity. You know, it's like being upside of a rabbit's asshole. It's just got so much like being fur all wrapped around your head. It's just horrible. It's like breathing a blanket, you know?
It is, it's terrible. But you know, that's the stuff that I took in, I internalized it, and I filed it away. Stephen King's novel about a guy that gets inside of his head and he's in this big room with all these books and file cabinets. That's what I do. I just took all that, and Joe does too. You file all that back, you remember all those things. And then when you finally decide you're going to write, and the only way that you can write a novel is to sit your butt down in a chair and write and quit talking about it. Well,
Talk about what you're doing.
No, I took all that and found my voice, which was the hardest thing in the world to do because I didn't understand what the writing voice was. Even when I was grown, no one could quite explain it to me. But when I got all that together, that first book, The Rock Hole, came out, and man, it hit pretty big.
What's a good book? That's a good book. I really love that book. It's scary too. It's kind of upsetting. Yeah, and the Burroughs is like, man, I talk about something creepy. That is a creepy, creepy book. And then the guy, the Skinner, you know, they think's come back, you know, in the other one. And I don't want to give stuff away. He's in a couple of books there. I don't want to give it away.
Yeah,
but what I will say is that to be a writer, what you got to do is that you've got to remember who you were and who you are now and why you are what you are, you know, and how you became where you are at that moment in time and be able to look back. I think that if you are able to do that, you've got enough material to last you for the rest of your life. You know, that doesn't mean you don't have new experiences, but those experiences are so vivid because it's your first time of experiencing those things and feeling that cold wind on your face and that rain and looking out and, you know, seeing a thunderstorm coming up over the trees or being out fishing and seeing mosquitoes rise up in a big, looks like a giant, you know, cloud. There's so many of them. And all of that stuff sticks with you. And if you have those kind of memories, and no matter what kind of story you're writing, if you bring those elements to it, it gives it a verisimilitude that you might not get otherwise, you know. In other words, it'd be just the story. It doesn't mean anything. Because I never really thought it was the story. I thought it was the characters and the atmosphere and the style. And what you said about voice, which you have, is a lot harder to find than people think. I remember a publisher told me, too, not only about voice and location, he said, you know, why don't you write about someplace real like Los Angeles or New York? And I thought, well, you son of a bitch. And I just kept doing it. But the truth is, even though it's your own voice you're looking for, you don't always recognize it because there are so many voices of other writers in the way. And I love those other writers because they help you find it. And you are influenced by them. When I look at my books, I see different writers in them. But I see that those are the ingredients that I've made my own, you know, meal out of, that I've sort of blended it all together. And you don't want like a potpourri of ideas. You want a blend of ideas. And then that's when you find your voice, and you find it when you least expect it. But you find it through doing what you said, is sitting your butt in a chair and writing.
You nailed it, when you least expect it, because I've been searching. I'd start, like other writers, I'd start a manuscript and I'd quit, or I'd start a story and quit because it never went, it didn't read well. And one day, I'm a retired educator of 35 years, and by the time I retired, I was the director of communications for the Garland ISD, one of the biggest school districts in the state of Texas. But I always had to go to these meetings that had nothing to do with me. And every time I go to the meeting, I would zone out. You've been to those. I just zone out.
Well, I went to some when I taught in college a little bit.
Well, it's the same
thing. I went to one and I said, I'm never going to another one. You can fire my ass if you want. I ain't doing that because I don't need to do this. You know,
well, that
I'm
was
one
it.
Of those unretired non-educators.
You chose a path that served you well. Mine served me well until that day. Yeah. And I was sitting there with a yellow legal pad. And a girl was sitting next to me, and she was writing like crazy. And she was in my department. And I said, what are you writing? You're not taking notes, because these people have nothing to do with what we're doing. And she goes, well, I'm writing a newspaper column. And I said, well, for what? She goes, for the Dallas Morning News. And I said, well, congratulations. I didn't know you were a columnist. And she said, well, I'm not. She said, I've never been published, but the crap I see in the newspapers these days, anybody can write. And, you know, I had been trying for years, and it pissed me off. So I took my legal pad. I told her, I said, I'm going to get published before you do. And I bet you $100 that I will. And she said, okay. And I sat there, and I'd been reading three different authors. I have several books going at any time. I mean, just wherever I happen to be sitting, there's a book. And I'd been reading a guy named Pat McManus. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Pat McManus. He was one of the funniest writers I've ever read. He wrote for Field and Stream and Outdoor Life. Very dry.
I know who he is.
Yeah. And then there was a guy named Gene Hill that I had been reading, and he was an outdoor writer, and a guy named Robert Rourke, and I'd been reading
certainly
him.
Robert. He was a Hemingway imitator.
He was, and you know what? I'd rather read him than Hemingway. And then there was this one guy.
I kind of think I go back to the original on that. I always thought he was kind of like he read like a parody. What was it? The Man and the Boy, or The Hunter and the Boy?
The Old Man and the Boy. Yeah, the Old Man and the Boy. I'd been reading him, and I'd been reading a guy named Donald E. Westlake.
Oh, yeah.
And all those guys got in the back of my head and started talking during that meeting. And I started to write, and it flowed so quickly. It was like 1,000 words that flowed out while I sat there. And I read that, and I thought, I think I have something here. And I took it, and I mailed it to the Paris News in Paris, Texas, where all my kinfolk are. And snail mail back in that day. I mean, I typed it on a 286 computer, and I printed it off on a tractor drive. You remember those days. And then I put it in an envelope and mailed it, just cold mailed it to the Paris News. And the editor called me about 3-4 days later. And he said, this is good. He said, I'm going to print this and I'll pay you for it, which was exciting for me. And then he said, can you do it again? I said, what do you mean? He goes, I want you to be our columnist for the Paris News, our outdoor humor columnist. And he said, let me see. Will you give me that same amount of money every time? And he said, yes. And when he did that, I became their columnist, and I've been writing for them for 33 years. But that polished my voice writing for that newspaper call. I took journalism
in high school, and that did it for me. I think journalism was in some ways a bigger influence on me than a lot of more obvious kinds of writing. But writers like Hemingway and like Ray Bradbury and Theodore Sturgeon and Raymond Chandler and Hammett and James Cane. And I mean, I can make a list that goes on and on, influenced me in certain ways. Donald Hamilton too. Donald Hamilton was one. And a lot of them influenced me, but it all kind of comes through. And that's why you can't find your voice at first, because your voice is their voice, or it's some version of their voice. And it's like, they're like ventriloquists making you do they're making you do their their voice. And
that's true.
It took a while for me to say, you know, I'm going to get that hand out of my ass and do my own writing. And once I finally got there, I said, oh, there that guy is. I know that guy. That's me.
That's me. And it starts to flow. And all you have to do is just open the gate and let it go. And that's what happened when they offered me the series for the Red River books. I mean, it flowed. Every time I sat down, that voice led me. My characters led me. I just followed along.
Exactly.
And then my third book, I got to look at the title, The Right Side of Wrong. When that one came out, one of my biggest honors was a reviewer said it reminded him of Donald Westlake's The Busybody and The Fugitive Pigeon. And I thought, you know, I can quit now. That's, I achieved that level. I am so good. But yeah, and there's another writer I'm compared to quite often. It's a guy named Joe Lansdale. And they call me Joe Lansdale.
We have a lot in common.
Yeah, we do. In fact, I did not get a book published by Joe's publisher because I sent it to them and they sent me a rejection notice through my agent and said, no, we already have a guy that writes like that. His name's Joe Lansdale. And so...
Well, I really meant we wrote about the same subjects, you know.
That's it, and that's true.
Similar subjects.
Yeah, we do. And you got your stories. I have my stories, and mine came from listening to the old men up at the country store back in those days when there was a store. You sat there and you drank your RC Cola and put peanuts in it, and you kept your mouth shut and listened, and that's what got it. That's what got
it. That was those old Redskin peanuts. You remember them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's full of and have all the little stuff get caught in your throat, nearly choke you to death.
Yeah.
Well, I did a lot of my listening was a lot of old black farmers when I was in Mount Enterprise. They had a place where some of the people actually arrived in wagons, you know, because they had their plows in the back and they had their mules pulling the wagon. So they would go where they were going and then they could hitch their mules up. And they still had a wagon yard out back where you could turn the wagon around. But they would park there waiting for their supplies, which unfortunately came after all the white people got theirs.
Right.
That meant when they got their seed and when they got, you know, whatever else it was that they need that they could get there, they had to wait. So they would sit on the steps, on the stoop, out there on those steps, because they all ran along Mount Enterprise in front of May Green's store and all that, where I read my first comic books. And they would talk. And when I'd first come up, they would all look at me and, you know, they'd start talking, and then after a while, I'd come up, and they thought, you know, this kid's all right, because I just sit there and listen. So I got a lot of my stories from them, and my father was a great source for stories, and so the two sources there had a big influence on me, as well as my grandmother and uncles and my mother to some degree. She wasn't much of a storyteller, but she had a real good memory for things that had happened in her past, and so all of that, along with books. And in fact, it may well be those things that encourage me so heavily to want to read, to want more story, you know? And so you got to have that background to bring the kind of stories that you do, you know, into fruition.
And you know what? And they still keep percolating up because Laying Bones is based on something that actually happened in the river bottoms when I was a kid in 1964. My dad's best friend was his first cousin, R.B. And he and R.B. grew up together running the hills. Well, they also got drafted together and went to in World War II. They both were sent to the Japanese theater and on different troop ships. They were both sitting off the coast of Japan when they dropped the bomb. They were the invasion force. And Dad had no idea where R.B. was. R.B. didn't know where Dad was. Well, after Japan surrendered, Dad was part of the occupying force in Tokyo. And he was at with his men one day, and I'm not a military guy, I didn't serve, but my dad was with his squad and they were at attention for whatever reason, and my dad looked up and saw RB marching past in another squad. Now this is two boys from Shakota, Texas, and they run into each other in Japan, and they're best friends and first cousins. Well, they broke ranks and hugged each other and got to wrestling and everything, and Dad said, come to
find
out,
that's what you do in East Texas, you wrestle.
Yeah, it's exactly what you do. You wrestle when you see your cousin. And so, oh, there's my grandson. Hey, buddy.
Hi, baby.
And so what happened was they wound up having 2 weeks of KP.
Dog, can I go up the ladder?
Not right now. Go back with him. Okay, thank you.
Can I be
Yeah. And so Hey, this is live, guys. This is how it is. And you know, we're pretty good right now because there's five others in the bedroom over there trapped right now till we get finished. But they served 2 weeks on KP, and those two guys ran Japan, and they did everything they were big enough to do while they were there. But then they came back, and Dad handled the war pretty well. RB did not. RB had more PTSD than most of the guys around there. And so he would go across the river to the honky tonks, and he would drink and try to kill that pain. It's the only thing he knew to do. And he did that for years until 1964. And one morning, my granddad, who was a constable in Lamar County, got a call that there was an overturned car down in one of the shallow creek beds down in the bottoms. And he went down there, and the car was there, and the body in the car was my dad's cousin RB. And so he went off, and they say he drowned. That was a story that we got, story I grew up with, but no one ever talked about it very much. I was at a funeral about 2 years ago talking to some relatives in Parrish, Texas, and my dad came up and RB came up in conversation. And my cousins I was talking to, who's in the middle of the late 80s, I said, you know, Dad loved RB. He missed him. And he said, and I told him, I said, you know, when RB died and drowned in that creek, he'd like to kill Daddy. And my cousin looked at me and he said, Rev, you don't know everything, do you? I said, don't know what? He said, RB didn't drown in that creek. There was only an inch of water in there, and he wasn't in it. He said, there was no water in his lungs. We think somebody killed him, rolled him off in there, and somebody covered it up. And Granddad never would talk about what happened. And so with that information, I kind of sat down and I thought, well, what happened over there? Yeah. And then I wrote my version of what could have happened to RB, because they were shooting dice over there. You know, anything could happen. But as I was researching this too, Joe knows Rivers as well as I do. He's got the Sabine down there and some of the others. We've got the Red River up in our part of the world. And these rivers, we get rain. East Texas, Northeast Texas, and I'm going to quote Joe Lansdale, is a world of water. And when it rains, these rivers get up, they twist out of their banks. And even in the Red River, even though it's controlled by a dam upstream, it will still change course. And there are several parts of Oklahoma that are now in Texas. And it's been that way for decades. And so Oklahoma, they're a land, but they can't get to it. And in Texas, law says, you know, it's over here, it's ours. But, you know, if you guys can figure out a way to get it back on your side, you can have it, do what you want to do with it. Well, that's where Laying Bones got the concept of this honky-tonk that they built on this orphan piece of Oklahoma land that's on the Texas side. Texas won't touch it, Oklahoma won't touch it, and this place gets out of control. And so, just talking to people and filing this stuff away and listening, it will create, you know, it will give you the material to do a book. And you know, you dream about them. Joe was talking about burrows. I dreamed about a place like that for years and years and years. And then, my wife told me, she said, well, you need to put that in a book. And I wrote the book Burrows, which is claustrophobic and dark and creepy. I haven't had that dream since. It's
now, same way with me. You know, I used to dream about the drive-in and being trapped in the drive-in and all this weird stuff happening. And I wrote this novel, The Drive-In, and pretty much that was it. And I wrote two other novels based on the fumes from it, which I thought were quite good. But that first one came in time. And once I wrote it, those dreams stopped. They didn't haunt me. They were present. And so I let it loose. And when I did, though, it was done. That happens with me with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I'll think about something for years and years and years. And I've always said, and sincerely, I don't plot. I don't sit down and plot my novels. Nothing against people who do that, although they're doing it wrong. But I'm joking. But whatever works for you works. But what I will say is that my subconscious is constantly plotting. Mm-hmm. And at some point it goes, hey, by the way, that story, that novel, it's finished. You need to kind of open the spigot and let it come out.
And get up and sit down and write it. You know, I've written a manuscript that's going to come out probably in 23. It's a prequel. It has one of my characters in the Red River series, Tom Bell. And it's Tom Bell in Gladewater, Liberty City back in 1931 during the oil boom. And so,
that's an interesting time, man.
Oh man, it was wild. And the more research you do, the wilder you find out it was. Well,
yeah, I've written about it a few times. I know.
Yes, you have. And all there, every one of them is a great book. And you know, those percolated. While we were, you know, we were locked down for COVID, one night in June, I had a dream that, Joe, I don't know if you've ever had this. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I even wrote the dialogue. I got up at 4 o'clock
all in the morning.
Time
for me.
Oh yeah, I'd never had that happen. I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, wrote over 5,000 words before my wife woke up. I wrote the entire novel in 6 weeks, which is unheard of for me because I usually take about 6 months per project. But you know that one, it's a weird Western. It's got medicine men and dead people who are not zombies. Oh, listen, Joe, I should send you the manuscript. You're gonna love this one because it's right up your alley. And right now it's called Comancheria, but we'll see where it winds up before it's all over with. But you know, these are the things that writers do that come so easy for me. I got into this late in the game. My first was published in 2011. Joe, you were published back in the 80s, I believe, or late 70s. 70s, yeah. And so, you know, some of us get to
73 was my first nonfiction, and then I went on to fiction by the mid-late 70s.
Yeah, you were doing that. In fact, if you could look up here on my bookcases up here, most of Joe's books are up here. They take up a lot of space. But my problem with him is he keeps writing them so fast, I can't stay up with everything that's being published right now. And Joe, I will publicly thank you for writing the introduction to The Rock Hole when it was re-released back in October, because that foreword is it's crisp. It really is crisp, and a lot of people ramble on for pages and pages. And you boiled it down, and you use phraseology that I can't create. But that introduction to The Rock Hole really made that release.
Well, you're welcome. It deserved it, and probably a better one, you know. But that's the best I could do. I always give it that. I'm doing the best I can do at the time. You know, it's a funny thing you said is I often dream complete dreams. I dream more better deals, and I wrote it in about 5 weeks, and then spent another week going back over it. But I just got up, started typing that story. And it was like, as soon as I put my fingers on the keys, it was there. I've had every once in a while, I'll have one that I sort of have to, you know, pull it out of the well, you know, with a hand over hand rope pull. But most of the time it's for me, it's just there. And I start writing it and at part time, I'll be working on another short story and sometimes another novel. You know, I wrote one that's coming out called Moon Lake. And Moon Lake's the hardest novel I ever written. I don't mean it's my best. I don't know. A lot of people love it. The publisher loves it. My agent loves it. The people that have read it involved in the industry love it. And it's one of those I really don't know. I figure it's pretty good. It's long for me, but I had a lot of trouble writing that one. And I don't know if it's because I needed that laser surgery I just got that makes the reading more comfortable, or if it was just the weight of the COVID and all of the stuff going on. But I'd get up every day and I fought that novel. I mean, I used everything I had and I wrestled, I punched, I rolled, and I thought it had my ass whipped for a while there, but I just wouldn't quit. You know, I just kept going at it because, you know, I don't like to quit anything unless I realize it's a turd, then I'll get rid of it. But I don't like to quit, you know, and I finally got it done. But that novel did not come to me in one big piece. It came to me in segmented dreams, and a lot of the segments that came to me were useless, or they were segments that I wrote and threw away, which usually, you know, I'm pretty close to what I'm going to do first time out. Like More Better Deals, I just wrote every day and it was finished, you know. But this one, man, it was inspired by dreams. And the dreams were really random this time. And I think too, I'd gotten spoiled by these dreams that organize themselves. And I don't know if you're like me, but I'm like being a director of a film. If I'm dreaming something and I feel like it's going off, I'll go, okay, stop in my brain and go back and fix it and keep going, just like I'm editing. You know, I do that just like I'm a film editor.
I've done that. I've gotten up and gone to the bathroom, come back and go back to bed, and then it picks up where I wanted to pick up again.
Yeah, me too.
And,
me
you too. Know, I often will write a chapter in these books that I'm pretty linear like you are. You read what you wrote the day before and then you do the day's work.
Right.
Every now and then a chapter will come to me and I'll sit down and write that chapter and just put it aside. It's not a short story. It doesn't fit anywhere, but my subconscious works on that. And then I'll get to a stopping place and I've got to read, and I'll just take that out, pull it back, plug it in, and it fits perfectly because it's your subconscious. I don't try to drive my characters. I don't try to drive my story. No. I think it'll die if you do that. You have to follow.
It's like pushing chess pieces around if you do that. It doesn't feel like real people. It doesn't feel like real motivations. You know, it's just it's the puppet. You know, and you're somebody else is working it, and you're just borrowing from this and that. You're not borrowing from the things that count. You're not borrowing from your own life. You're not borrowing from the influences that matter. You're just trying to make it happen. And you know, I've been guilty of that before and thought, you know, what's wrong with this story? I'll tell you what's wrong with this story. I'm not doing the story. I'm pushing it. And, you know, I think when you've been doing this for a while, there's a level that you don't fall below. And you know you're going to hit that level. And so you've always tried to push yourself to hit a higher level. But I'm also fully aware, I never try to beat the last book I wrote. I just think that's a loser's approach. I just say, this is the story I want to tell. And I can't beat the last book I wrote if I'm writing something very different, because what do I compare it to, you know? And so I try to, I've said it before and I mean it. I write like everybody I know is dead. I'm not interested in their opinion. I don't want anybody to tell me shit. Then when I get done, I hope they like it. Then I feel, you know, that I'm at the mercy of maybe somebody liking it, but I can't write with considering about agents and editors and markets and the bestseller list and all that stuff, because that's just not who I am, you know. And the more I felt like, you know, when I was younger, I try to hit that bestseller list, I would just write something that was so derivative, you know, and I wasn't hitting what I wanted to do. If I hit the bestseller list, I want it to be on my own terms, not on, you know, this sort of like, again, pushing those chess pieces around.
Exactly. Hey, you can't chase what everybody else is reading right now, because that changes so far out. You know, you and I will finish a manuscript, and it may be a year or 2 years before it hits the shelves. And so if you're trying to trace the trend, you're not going to make that. But, I learned something from you, and I have a mutual friend also that I learned from a few years ago. He and I were talking, and a guy named David Morrell. I think most everyone knows.
Oh, yeah, David, yeah.
Yeah, David gave me some good advice. He gave a room full of people some good advice, but I listened and I filed it away. He said, if you get to a point in your writing and your story stalls and your characters stall, he says, there's no such thing as writer's block. What you've done is you forced your characters into doing something that they don't need.
Exactly.
To throw that chapter out, back up, and start again.
Right. I don't believe in writer's block for me. I believe there may well be people who experience it. I'm not going to belittle those losers, but what I will say is that I just don't believe in writer's block for me. I'm joking, of course. I do believe there's some people that, you know, maybe psychologically they have trouble, but most of the time I have writer's drag sometimes where it's coming a little slower, or maybe that scene isn't as clear, because I feel that way primarily because everything usually comes, I don't want to say easy, but it comes very fast and full, and then all of a sudden when it doesn't, you know, I feel like, well, maybe this isn't so good. Maybe about halfway through everything, I think it's awful. And so then a little bit later, it'll start picking up again and it's fine. But a lot of people, they refer to writer's block any day they don't want to work. That's not writer's block. That's you not working.
Yeah.
Or they refer to writer's block as any day when it's difficult. Well, you know, nobody said it was going to be easy. I mean, you should have got a degree and taught somewhere, you know. But it's one of those things is that writer's block is, once you convince yourself it's real, you'll have it, I guarantee you. But what if you think it's not real, or you understand it's like saying you're poor, and we never said that, we said we were broke.
Yeah,
that meant things would get better. And it's the same way, you're not blocked, you're stalled.
Yep, that's absolutely right. There's so much out there to write about. I don't have the time to write about all the stories that are rattling around in my head right now. I had a couple pop up today that I just ideas that could turn into novels, but I just don't have the time to do it, you know, because when you're working on your manuscripts, as many as you have going, I have three or four right now that I'm working on. You know, you don't want to add anything else to that list till you get something off your plate. And that's how it works for me anyway.
Me
you guys
too.
Mind if I jump in just for a second here?
Please.
Yeah. I was just wanted to ask you both a little bit about Texas in the 1960s. You know, Revis, obviously the series is set during that period from the first book. And by the way, this is the really attractive reissue with Joe's intro.
It does look good.
And then we'll also say a little bit about your other series, you know, and this is the most recent one in that.
Yes.
But, you know, it seems like for both of you, and I know I've been reading Joe for a long, long time, and you know, the 60s and the experience of the 60s seems to be, Joe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like such a part of your DNA. And
it is.
You know, in recent years, you've written these really exquisite Cap and Leonard short stories that kind of go back in time into that period. And you're talking about race relations. You're talking about what it was like in the 60s. I don't know. Can you guys both maybe talk about, you know, you're in different parts of the state, but how that living through that time was for you and how it
informed your work? I'll let Ray go first here, then
I'll... Well, you know, those years formed us. You know, I was a victim of rock and roll. It got a hold of me when the Beatles came in, and most of my novels have the music in them to set the tone, to set the time, because music's a great time machine anyway, you know. And you hear a song, you're immediately transported back to that car in that drive-in with that girl, or you know, something really cool happened to you and that music was going on. So, you know, the music helped define a lot of what I write about. But, you know, Texas was not a microcosm, but it was just a small snapshot of the entire country. You know, racism was rampant in Northeast Texas, and I know it was in East Texas also. There were cafes and restaurants where you know, Black folks had to go through the back door, not the front door. And that's in my books. One of my major characters is John Washington, who was a real guy. He was a huge. He looked like the guy in Green Mile. He was that big to me as a kid. I mean, he was a hoss. And I wanted to show the struggles that he had as a lawman in the 1960s. And he worked with my granddad very closely. Granddad was kind of a Renaissance man. And so they worked very closely together on several cases, and I would see John. So, you know, we had that world, you know, toward the late 60s, you know, the rock and roll got darker, you know, the war spun up, there were protests, there were riots starting in 64 and through 65, 66 and Watts and in LA and those types of things. So, you know, what we're seeing now in a lot of ways is a resurgence of that kind of thing. People trying to make their point, trying to get everybody to listen to what they have to say, which is what we were trying to do through the music, through the kids, you know, the hippies, the marches, the rock and roll. And so, but it's at the same time, it was pure Americana. That was East Texas, Northeast Texas, where I grew up. My granddad would borrow money on a handshake from the bank. You know, people respected each other. There was courtesy. And it was probably more idyllic less idyllic than I choose to remember, but it was a great time and a great place to grow up.
Well, nostalgia is a big liar in a lot of ways, but there's so many wonderful things about growing up then, because you're young and you don't know how bad things are. And it's not that I think the world's bad. I'm not an optimist, but I'm a positive guy, because I don't want to be an optimist, because the opposite of that is pessimist. And both of them seem to be extremes, you know. And it's, I was a 60s guy. I was a Vietnam War resistor. I was drafted. I refused to go. I nearly went to prison. That's a long story. I've told it before. I won't bore people with it. But the music I first really remember hitting me was Hank Williams, and he was already dead, you know, and they were still playing him and Ernest Tubb and all that stuff. And then along come Elvis Presley. I thought, what is that? And then that led to me listening to these guys called Muddy Waters and all of these, Black musicians that I would catch when the weather was right. You could tune in to some of these channels that played Black music, you know, race records, they called them. Yep. And so that all influenced me. And then, you know, when the Beatles came along, that was not only a musical revelation. I didn't really like the early Beatles much. I've learned to. It was when Sgt. Pepper hit that I all of a sudden said, whoa, boy, something's going on here. Yep. And then the White Album, that's my favorite album by them. But all of that begin to affect the cultural aspect. I mean, I had hair all the way down, you know, the middle of my back. I was, like I said, I was a Vietnam War resistor. I was in civil rights stuff. I mean, I was all that stuff. And it was especially hard being where I was from, because I wasn't dressing like everybody else. I didn't look like everybody else. I didn't have the same, I was an atheist on top of that, to just to make it special. And so there was all of this stuff, and you know, it was a different for me. But East Texas, though, it's always been a fascinating place to me. And I do sometimes get offended when people think that there's, you know, there's this line, and everybody in the South is this way, and everybody in the North is this way, as if during the Civil War, everybody rose up in self-righteous indignation to change the nation. That doesn't mean any defense for the racism in the South at all, but racism was rampant throughout. It was worse in the South because of slavery. But you know, you had people that didn't want to serve with black soldiers. They didn't even want to have black soldiers in their army, which was a bad idea to not do it, because once they added them, that made a big difference, you know? And still they didn't trust them. So in other words, there's always been this kind of white, we're better, and you know, we're going to be kind to them. It's kind of like the way they did the American Indian. We're your father white guys, instead of like, you know, we're all equal people and we're trying to work this thing out here and figure out our social and cultural differences, you know? And so to me, all of that's always intrigued me. And I knew old men that had the worst language, worst racist language in the world, that would never mistreat somebody black and would deal with black people all the time. And that was people they considered friends. And then I knew people that were just as smooth as they could be in the way they talk, and they wouldn't have a black person in their yard. I mean, it was all of it's so mixed and complicated. And that's what fascinates me about characters and about language. And what scares me these days, when you have things where it's all got to be this way or that way, or that we can't talk about bad things, when exactly you should talk about bad things to keep them from happening again. And that you should look at it in a real and honest manner, not some manner that's politically correct. And I'm not against political correctness in certain ways, but I'm totally against political assholeness. You know, I just think that you don't need to look at everything as them or us, because people are more complicated than that. And I've told the story before, but my father was a racist, and he was a verbal racist, terrible stuff. But, you know, if he didn't have black customers for his mechanic business, he wouldn't have had any. And when he went squirrel hunting, he always brought extra squirrels or extra fish for the black people he knew. He wouldn't call them friends, but they were, you know? And I saw him one night stop in the middle of a rainstorm when a car full of black family had broken down, and my father stopped and got out in the rain when another white people were going by and just yelling horrible, horrible things at these poor people who were in this storm. And my father got under that car and fixed it with water running over him, and it was cold. And when he got back in the car, he was shivering. And I said to my dad, I didn't say anything. I just looked at him, and he knew, because I'd heard all this racist rhetoric. And I'm always saying, well, you know, I love Little Richard. I like this and I like that. And later I like Muhammad Ali, but at that point I was younger than that. And he said, well, those kids were wet. Those kids were going to get cold or something like that. And I knew who he was. And for us to all boil this down to some sort of woke moment, when woke in concept is wonderful, but when it has rules, it's not. Or you have people in publishing that goes, we're not ever going to use this word, no matter if it is meant to show you the ugliness of that moment in time. And so to me, that's what scares me, because that's how things like this repeat themselves. And when everybody starts saying everybody's equal now, it's a perfect playing field. No. And that's why you have Black Lives Matter. You know, they're tired of that shit. And things are better than they were when we were growing up, because they couldn't go into a restaurant. They couldn't go to the same water fountain. They didn't have the chance to work jobs that the lowest of what we call white trash, that'd be me. And we could work jobs they couldn't get. Some of the worst jobs you can imagine. And they couldn't get them because their skin was black. So I'm not for this all, let's make it all shiny and cool, because you don't want to forget. I mean, it depends on what you're writing. But if you're writing about history and you're trying to write about those things that matter, those things that wounded you, and the biggest scar on my soul is racism, you need to write about them with honesty. You know, a word is a word. It's the context that makes all the difference in the world.
No. See, that's what Joe and I do. We I'll flinch a little bit. Joe will flinch less than I do, but we write about that time period and we write about those people as honestly as we possibly can. And I think that's what makes our books so readable. Our dialogue is true to the area. We're losing that. We're losing our accents here in North and East Texas.
Yeah, we used to have accents till we growed up.
Somebody said I had one time, but I don't know what they were talking about. You know, Joe and I were in a truck with a mutual friend of ours, Saba from Italy. Pronounce his last name again. Saba
Pazzini.
And Joe and I got to talking, and we talked for about 10, 15 minutes, and finally Saba said, "Would you guys stop for a second?" I said, "What?" He goes, "I haven't understood a word y'all said in the last 15 minutes. What are you talking about?"
And he spoke good English. And the problem, if I get around people from Gladewater for more than a couple of hours, then I start talking like this. And this whole idea about drawing in Eastern Texas is not true. That's West Texas and North Texas that draw. We bark.
We bark. We're choppy.
We're choppy. We talk faster too.
We get talking real fast. We use phrases and words that people don't understand. You know.
Yeah. It's five different dialects in Texas and probably variations thereof, and some of that is disappearing. Like my son doesn't have nearly as much of an East Texas accent. He has some. My daughter, she's got it, and it's probably because she's a country singer. But mm-hmm. She sounds like she's from East Texas for sure. There's no doubt about that. And my wife doesn't have much of one either.
Yeah, we just embrace it. We go with it, and there's folks that,
I'm not ashamed of my accent at all,
No, not at all. I knew a girl, my wife knew a girl, her name Donane, and Donane talked like this all time. And, I understood everything she'd say, but if you put it on TV these days, they'd put subtitles under Joe and I and some of these other folks. Does that answer your question, Patrick? No.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. They do. They have put subtitles under me. I think I'm very clear.
I am too. I know exactly what I say.
Well, Revis, can you talk a little bit about just a little bit about the protagonist? I know you've talked a lot about him before, but Ned Parker. Is there a lot of Revis in Ned, or is he more? Where does he come from?
Ned is loosely based on my granddad, who was a farmer and a constable in East Texas from the 40s all the way up until the early 80s when he retired. And so I watched him. I'd go out on calls with him as I got older. I learned about his job. I learned about the things he dealt with. Constables back in those days, it was mostly drunk driving or some minor break-ins on occasion. Usually, it's family squabbles and they have to settle down. And so we lived at his house. He had a party line in his house, which is kind of not good for a constable. But I think there were three other people on that line. And so
get off the line, goddammit.
Exactly. and every time his phone rang, you knew that the lady down the line, you hear her pick it up so she could hear what was going on because she wanted to be in the know, and then she'd call everybody else. It was their form of Facebook, it got the information really fast. And so I'd watch him, and I watched him deal with people, and I watched him deal with drunks and people that wanted to fight, and he was so smooth and so cool. And then he did what he needed to do and dealt with folks. I think truly, my Ned Parker, he'll shoot you at the drop of a hat, just like Happy Leonard will. But my granddad only pulled his pistol once, as far as I know, that he told me about. And it was when he pulled a car over. There were four guys got out and all of them had weapons. And so he pointed to one guy and he said, "I'm going to shoot you first. And then I'm going to go work on the other three. And when we're done, I'm going to still be the one standing there." And people still tell that story today. And so Ned Parker was that guy. He was also married. My grandmother was half Choctaw, and I didn't realize it was a mixed marriage when I was a kid. And I don't even think of it that way. But I had someone point that out to me. You said your granddad was married to an Indian up on the Red River, and some people, they didn't kind of take to that. Although we all have the lineage. In fact, here's a strange one, Patrick. My lineage and my daughter's lineage goes back to Joe. Joe is related to my daughter from my first marriage. And so, that's East Texas for you. You can't talk about anybody because you're kin to them, And that's the world we write about. And so Ned dealt with all those things, and he dealt with the racism and in the Rock Hole, they want to go have a hamburger when they pull up in front of a hamburger store over in Oklahoma, there's a sign up there that says no dogs or Indians allowed. And the friend of mine, he experienced that. He said what hurt him worse was they had dogs above the Indians. And you know, we were second even to the dogs. And you know, so Ned lived in that world. He saw that world, but he loved kids. He loved people. He'd be up at the store all the time. And so I hung a lot on Ned. Now, as far as me being in Ned, very little of myself. You know, people see a lot of Top, my protagonist, my young boy, in me, and a lot of me is in him. You know, I use that as a framework, and honestly, I use a lot of those experiences I had when I was a kid as the experiences that Top dealt with, because why go make something up if I know it firsthand?
You know, it's funny. Yeah. You think I talked to Joe quite a bit about this because we're both big history buffs, especially Western and history. Just how close we really are to that frontier period. You know, you're just talking about was your grandfather, right? And right. You know, the period from the 40s to the 80s, and what a fascinating chunk of time that was to you know, to be in your prime. You know, you think about it, the early part of that in the 40s, there's still plenty of elderly Civil War veterans kicking around. Maybe not plenty, but there are some.
I think the last one died in the 50s, if I remember.
In the 50s, yeah.
I think the last living one died in the 50s.
Yeah.
And I could be wrong on that exactly, but I think I'm right.
But these
I saw, a little longer.
Yeah, the people, I saw a photo of them in a parade. I think you're right, Joe, in the late 40, a couple, you know, 10 or 15 of these old guys.
Yeah.
But certainly
some of the beard, yeah.
Certainly the
Indian
Wars,
my dad was born
too.
In 1909, so he wasn't but just a few years from when they talked about the closing of the frontier. But, you know, there wasn't just a line drawn in the dirt. I mean, when they lived in East Texas, my father still rode horses, and they had buggies and wagons. He told me when he saw the first airplane, which was a biplane, you know, and it was probably a carnival or something where they were doing it, you know. I wish I'd paid more attention to that, but it was an impressive moment for him, you know. And he grew up, reached his adulthood in the Great Depression. So, he wasn't that far from the stories that his uncles or great uncles told him about the Civil War. Those guys were still alive, mm-hmm. you know, and they may have been old men, but they were still alive. And it was amazing. And I had my DNA done. We'd always been told that we were Native American. We did not. We were not. We were everything else. I mean, I'm Romanian. I'm Southern Italian. I'm Turkish. And that's all. I am a sort of South American. So maybe there's a South American Native American. So maybe that a little bitty bit, you know, that little spot in my eye. And then Polynesian, which is interesting. But the rest of it is like a full third of it is Irish, as you would expect, and Scottish, British, in other words, now, and Spanish and Portuguese and all of that. And then another bunch is all Viking, you know, Swedish and Norwegian. DNA is such an interesting thing. And it's so weird that we get so uptight about people that we consider different.
Yep.
We're all different.
We are. We're all a blend. And you know, that blend came from the Western, you know, the Western expansion. You know, all the people that came over, you know, they came over looking for a better life, and they hung around the East Coast for a while, and they thought, hey, there's free land, let's all go west. But people think that, you know, half the cavalry soldiers were not just white guys. They were a mix of all languages, Germans, Italians, you know, there were a mix of people in the Buffalo soldiers. So, but a lot of people think that the West died out and when the year 1900 rolled around. Most people don't know that the last Indian attack on Texas soil was in 1923. Some of Geronimo's band that had been hiding down across the river, and they came up and hit a little village down on the Rio Grande down in there. And so, you know, what we write is maybe they're not pure Westerns, but they are Westerns in many senses, you know, and that's what we are. We're Texas. We're the
way. You know, I use the tools of that, you know, and one of the things is people say, well, your novels have got a lot of violence in them. You wouldn't do violence. I said, no, I wouldn't, but I'm writing crime novels, man. Mm-hmm. They got crime in them. And I said, the heroes are not always just perfect kind of people. I don't consider Happ and Leonard, you know, role models, at least in the standpoint of how they deal with, you know, people by killing them, which they do sometimes, you know, but there is a sort of morality play at work. And it's all a kind of metaphor for a bigger idea. And you know, if you take it literally, then that's on you. That's yep. not on me yep. because I make it very clear that it, and you know, sometimes I think the stuff reads very much like a metaphor or like a morality tale. And strangely enough, I think that I was so influenced by the Lone Ranger and the Rifleman and, you know, Wanted Dead or Alive and all those things, which were always about 30-minute morality tales, well, nearly every one of them.
They were, yeah, that's exactly. And you know what? We write to entertain. If I did a police procedural and you watch these guys and you read about these guys investigating for 300 pages, you'd be pulling your hair out or throwing it against the wall. You know, that's not what we do. We write to entertain. And so I have these big finishes. Joe has these dramatic endings. That's what we want, though. We want justice at the end of the book, and that's what I think we provide.
Yeah, you know, it's metaphorical justice.
Yes.
Yeah. I think what we're all probably fascinated with is that period, you know, right before television, you know, that the pulp era, mm-hmm. you know, when these writers were writing in all genres. You know, you'd have people writing hard-boiled detective stories. You'd have people writing Western stories. And I love that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Weird stories.
Most of it's just terrible, terribly written, but the best of it's awesome. And if I was about 12 back then, oh my God. And if I was growing up in that market as a writer, I would have been like writing all over the place. You know, Andrew Bax and I were talking, man, we'd have been kings back then. We could have written all over.
Revis, can you talk a little bit, because we've talked mostly about your other series, but can you talk about, you know, the Hawk series and kind of, you know, the Texas Rangers, obviously they're iconic figures in our national history and our identity. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with this series as opposed to the Ned Parker series?
Yeah, the Hawks, the Sonny Hawk series featuring my Ranger, Sonny Hawk, they're pure thrillers. That's what they are. They're a rocket ship ride from the beginning to the end. You know, again, talking about David Morrell, he and I were on an interview panel together, and someone asked about what's the difference between a mystery and a thriller, and his, you know, we all know the mystery. You look for the bad guy. You want to find out who the person was that committed the crime. Well, the thriller, you know who committed the crime right at the outset. And David and I kind of looked at each other and nodded when that came up, because because that was my answer. It's a roller coaster ride. I know who the bad guy is. I'm along for the ride until they take the bad guy down one way or the other. And that's what this is all about. Sonny's a contemporary Texas Ranger. They're my version of Westerns. They take place mostly out in the Big Bend or down the Rio Grande. But the third book in that series, Hawk's Target, that won a Spur Award last year, it started in Big Bend and up into Amarillo, Texas, and then it went all the way down to Comanche, Texas, and wound up not far from Joe. The climax was in the deep east Texas, not far from Jasper, where, you know, we went run into a bunch of Cajuns that are down in those swamps down in there, and there's everything in the world in that one. I threw the whole trash can in, and so, you know, Sonny is not your typical Ranger. He's not assigned to one district. He's kind of one of the, I don't know if you've ever played softball back in college. My favorite position was a rover. I didn't play bases or outfield. I went between left and right field. I was running all the time. That's Sonny Hawk. He's a rover. His commander sends him to where problems are, like they used to do back in the old Ranger days. You were one riot, one Ranger. And so Sonny's a family man. He deals with the crimes down along the border that don't get much footage on TV, but he has his own blend of justice. And Sonny, unlike what we can do, Sonny is not opposed to stepping across the border to gather information on a crime, which is what happens in the last one, Hawk's Fury. He goes after a drug king who, the head of a cartel. He's trying to find out who killed some people up here, who's killing Border Patrol agents, which is based on a true story. And so he goes to the border, finds a police officer he's worked with on the Mexican side of the border, and he crosses over to go ask questions and do a little research and work on this. But what happens once he gets over there is he can't get back. The cartels are after him, and so Sonny has to work his way back to the Texas border with the person he's arrested, which you can't do. But, you know, again, this is entertainment. This is what it is. This is fun. It's a fun ride. So the Sonny Hawk series, the fourth one was Hawk's Fury, that came out in May. And it's got a great response because people just like that swashbuckling kind of guy. You know, I guess that's what he's, kind of a Texas Errol Flynn. He'll wade into it. Now he's impulsive. He gets in trouble all the time. He's not a planner. He's like Joe and I, the way we write. He gets in the middle of it and sees how it comes out on the other end, but it's worked out well. He's gained quite a following.
You know,
we were having one thing is talking about a difference in a thriller and a mystery, but I've read thrillers that were mysteries too. And I say the definition is it reads faster.
There you go. That's fast.
We had a conversation with Ace Atkins last night.
Yeah.
Terrific.
I like Ace.
Terrific writer, great guy. And, you know, he's writing, you know, he continued the Robert B. Parker franchise, mm-hmm. and it's done just a great job, but also writing his own, you know, mystery series set in rural Tennessee. I'm embarrassed if I have the state wrong, but it's basically a modern version of a Western hero, and we were talking about right now in the current climate that we're in. I think there is a real, you know, demand for a return to characters that have some sort of moral code. You know, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but that have integrity, that have
certain ethics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah,
I think it's right.
That's what we try to write. We my characters are the people that I want to come save me, to be my friend, to be someone I can hang out and talk with and to visit with. You know, we all write about. I heard someone say writers write about what they've been. They've all been damaged in some way, and they write about the damage that has been done to them. I think a lot of times when I was younger, Joe is master in self-defense. I am not. I was that little asthmatic kid, so I had to deal with problems on my own. And several instances in my life, I wish somebody had been there to come stand beside me, you know, to be there with me. And that has, you know, and if that's affected me over the years. And so, you know, things I write about, my guys always have somebody to lean on. You know, I don't have this one great strong guy to take care of everything. He has friends, he has relatives, he has acquaintances that will stand beside him. And that's what we all want. We want somebody to stand next to us to be with us and through thick and thin, you know, and whatever it is. You know, Joe knows if he needs me, he call me. I'll drive Nacogdoches. Yeah, I might have to load the trunk up with shotguns and come out there and help him out that way, because I'm not going to chop sock him. But, you know, that's what you do.
Bring the hound dog.
That's exactly. Bring that dog. Let's go find him.
I think that's true. In my books, though, there's a lot of characters. Some of my books, I don't want to be with those guys. I mean, I think, but they represent people that I've known or people that I have suspected of certain things. Like mm-hmm. the guy in More Better Deals, I think he's kind of likable in some ways, but when you know his inner tickings, he's got some things that don't make him all that lovable, you know. But I think it's just fun, you know.
Well, it is fun. I knew a guy, and I'll never reveal who he is. He kept two bags of lime in the back of his car all the time. Now, you know, there's a whole story unto itself, and I know that.
I already see where that's going.
yeah, and you know what? Some of those were new bags that I saw back there too. Maybe he was using them in an outhouse, Joe. Yeah. Maybe that's what
they used to do. That put a little bit of bucket of lime down in the shitter. Yeah. And sometimes they put that on top of a body.
There you go. That's it. See? But those are the things that you collect and you file away, and that character is going to wind up in the book that I'm working on right now. So that's what we do. That's how I try to spice them up and give them something that you're really gonna keep reading. You know, I in my books, my chapters are not long. They're longer at the front of the book than the back. The first act, they're a little longer. They get shorter in the second act. By the third act, man, it's amping up and it's moving fast. And that also helps the reader understand the tension that's building, whether you write it in or not, because it's happening so quickly like that. So it, little tricks that I learned from, you know, some of the masters that that I've read, been around all my life. The masters are here behind me. I don't know. Let me show you this. This is my new library that we just built not too long ago. Wow. And these are the people that influenced me, that taught me, and this just keeps going and going. These are the people that influenced me and taught me how to write, because I read. And that's what I tell everyone. If you're going to be a writer,
you can't write if you don't read.
That's right.
I had a woman tell me that she had like a bestseller. She's never read a book in her life. And I talked to her about 30 minutes, realized she had read books.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she referenced them.
Yeah. You know? So
and I think that was just her shtick. You know, she wanted to do that. And
yeah.
So that's how it is, you know.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate both.
I don't respect being called a gentleman.
That's true.
But he is. He's Texas gentleman.
Revis and Joe, thanks so much for spending this hour. Thank it's you. Been great. And just to show everybody again, here's Joe's latest book. And
it was a great book. I read it. Terrific
book.
Yep.
Was that like a 60, late 60s caddy, Joe?
Yeah, 64, 64 in there.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly, but I think it's 64, 62 maybe.
Incidentally, I remember watching the opening scene of Happ and Leonard, the TV show, and they destroy that vintage caddy, and my heart just... They rebuilt it. And then here's Revis's new book.
It was fine. I'll make you feel better. It was fine.
Both of the new books.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, have a great night. And thanks everybody for tuning in and stay safe out there.
Thank you.
See y'all in person for too long.
I hope so. Thank all y'all.
I'm tired of this shit. All right, guys.
All right. Adios, gentlemen. Have a good one.
Take care.
Thank you now. Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.